Welcome to Talking New Energy, a podcast from Delta EE, the new energy experts. We'll be talking about how the energy transition is developing across Europe, with guests who are working at the leading edge of this transition. Hello, and welcome to the episode. Today, we're looking at the future of gas in the energy system. Over the past few decades, natural gas has been regarded as a relatively clean fuel, in particular when compared to coal, for example. But looking forwards, if we're going to decarbonise our energy system in the next decades, then there really can't be an extensive and widespread role for natural gas because of its associated carbon emissions. This is a challenge given today it's used extensively for heating across Europe and its significant role in power generation in some countries. But don't write off gas too quickly. Its flexibility is becoming increasingly valuable, and decarbonised and renewable gases could well have an important and maybe extensive role in the future. Of these, there's growing hope around hydrogen in particular. So, to discuss the role of natural gas in the future, I'm joined today by James Watson, Secretary General of Gas Industry Trade Body Eurogas, and Delta EE expert Rob Bloom. Hello, James.
Hello, John.
Thanks for joining us, and hello, Rob, as well.
Hi there.
So, James, I'd like to start with a question for you. What's the mood like in the European gas industry today? You know, gas industry has a huge role in the energy sector today. The future, as I said, will need to look quite different. So on one hand, you could imagine there might be doom and gloom as the pressure builds on natural gas. But on the other hand, there may be lots of excitement about the opportunities or nervousness about the changes required. How would you characterise the mood today?
Well, I think if you look at the context of the gas market in Europe today, you might imagine that we could possibly be feeling super happy and on top of the world. And I say that in reference to events I saw recently where Fatih Birol from the International Energy Agency was showing the predictions that his organization has had for gas growth through to 2018, and they made predictions back in about 2012. And they called it the golden age of gas. I'm sure you probably remember that, John, whole report. You know, we are living in the golden age of gas. Indeed, the predictions the International Energy Agency had were more or less lived today. So, yeah, you would think that probably we're all having a party or enjoying good discos, but it's not like that at all. That's a funny thing, isn't it? If you think that, you know, we are living in what would be called the golden age of gas, according to some analysts and predictors. I think what we find is that there is a kind of a shift in mentality. I mean, the gas industry understands that we are doing very well today, but the future is, of course, more or less unpredictable. We know that we are going to be in a situation in Europe where we have to achieve a carbon neutral economy by 2050. And what I have seen across our sector and recently all of our members clubbed together and agreed to support that objective. Understanding all of the challenges that entails for our sector, as you pointed out in your introduction, we are still a CO2 emitter, much less CO2 than traditional fossil fuels like oil, lignite and coal, diesel. And nevertheless, we will have to reduce that carbon footprint to live in a carbon neutral economy in Europe. I mean, globally, gas is the fastest growing fuel globally, and in other jurisdictions, gas will be undoubtedly the only means that we can use to achieve the overall objectives of the Paris Agreement, limiting warming to 2 or 1.5 degrees centigrade. But in Europe, we have a different challenge, and it's a challenge to achieve carbon neutrality by 2050. And so I think if you look at it, our members, the gas industry, are starting to invest and devise new plans, new business models to bring forward new types of gas that we hope we'll be able to blend in as we go forward.
So, James, that's a heady mix of threat and opportunity there. Investors in startup businesses, in the venture capital, in the private equity sector, will always say there's only two emotions that matter, and that's threat or fear and opportunity. Is there more of one than the other, or is that a bit unfair to ask you to characterise
characterise that?
Oh, no, I don't think it's unfair at all, John. I think it's a fair point. I mean, there is, of course, the risk. If you do nothing, what will happen to your business? What will happen to your model? We know very well, we've just had a new commission president put in place, and she's promised to deliver a law by 2050 that we have carbon neutrality in Europe. So that will become a law. Of course, we as the gas sector support that. And so therefore, we have to see that as an opportunity and not just think about a threat. We have to think about how actually you are not going to be able to electrify everything. That's very clear. There is no way that you can build enough renewable electricity to deal with peak energy demands in winter. The European Commission themselves are very clear that they want gas. They need gas. They're still forecasting. They're still forecasting a market of gaseous fuels in 2050, which is only about a third less than it is today.
So a big role for gas. You talked about the need to change and to have, whether it's new business models, new technology, different approaches. How well laid out or how clear do you think the industry is? Or are we still at the relatively early stages of exploring those and trying to define those?
Well, I think that the right way of looking at this is that we are at that beginning of that story. We are at the moment looking at how we can increase the amount of biogas, biomethane, that is available. Because if you think of biomethane, this is a good product that you can directly inject into the grid with no need for any change of infrastructure whatsoever. And so I think we are very much at the start of that story. If I might just throw a statistic in, John, I mean, the market that we have in gas today is 95% natural gas and 5% biogas. If you think about electricity, you're around about 50% still fossil fuel and about 18% that's variable renewables. Those 18% have more or less grown in the last 15 years. So our story is perhaps, if you argued behind the electricity story, but then we haven't necessarily seen the same kind of incentives and programs put in place for gas as we have for electricity. So my view is we're at the beginning of the story, and we hope over the next 30 years that we will actually go through our own transition and increase the amounts and volumes that we have of the renewable gases.
Okay, well, let's look then at those low carbon and renewable gases and break it down a bit for the benefit of our listeners. So when it comes to low carbon and renewable decarbonized gases, we could break it down in two ways, what the source of the energy is and whether that gas is either partially or fully decarbonized. So, Rob, I'll ask you in a minute about hydrogen, but James, can you firstly just walk us through biogas and biomethane in relation to these points?
Yes, John. I think the way that we see it is very much in line with the recently enacted Renewable Energy Directive, which came out of the Clean Energy Package. And there are clear definitions for biomethane and biogas. And basically, they're considered renewable to the extent that the feedstock that is used to produce it is considered sustainable, and the overall process allows for reduction of greenhouse gas emissions. The way that we see this is that you therefore focus much more on the second generation types of biomethane and biogas production. So this is wastes. There are extensive lists of all the different types of waste feedstocks you can have. These vary from sewage and wastewater, through to manure, through to agricultural waste byproducts. And so that ultimately what you're using is a second generation approach to deliver the biogas and biomethane that you want. I think that you have to say, to consider renewable, the gas has to have certain requirements around its sustainability of the feedstock. And so it is important for us that we aren't talking about growing food crops to be put directly into anaerobic digesters, because we are very aware of what happened on the biofuel debate, and you get trapped in a food versus fuel discussion politically, which helps no one, and then even starts, you know, driving some public perception against the idea of doing this. And in fact, we really need to do this. So we really have to work on the basis of what I call second generation. So that's waste, essentially.
Yeah. Okay. And then once you've got that biogas, you could either blend that into the network and blend it with natural gas, or upgrade it to biomethane, if I understand correctly.
Well, yes, that's how we would see it. So the biogas production at the moment contains impurities, so a lot of the volume is actually used to produce electricity. So you can actually really just burn biogas relatively easily and inject that into the electricity grid. But the real premium, and we're, you know, about two billion cubic meters today production in Europe is biomethane, where you have to upgrade it, burn the impurities off, and then you inject it into the gas grid, and then it can be used for whatever purpose, heating, industrial use, even of course gas power today, so electricity. But in principle, that's the way that we're looking at how you increase the amount of biomethane.
Okay, and how much waste resource is there out there in your view? Presumably not enough to replace, substitute natural gas with biogas from waste across the whole of Europe, but can you give us a feel for the level of bioresource or waste, bio-waste that you think is out there?
It's the sort of million-dollar question, isn't it, John?
Yeah.
Actually, the multi-billion-dollar question, John. I think there are very, very many different studies with different views on this, and the reality is, of course, we will have to see how those basically how those feedstocks develop and the finance that is associated with them, what the costs are. There is a study by Navigant which suggests something around 200 plus billion cubic meters. Another was done earlier, I think by the same organization, it's called Ecofys, which suggests around 100. In Eurogas, we are conducting our own study, and we will have to see what we come up to later this year. But my view would be that you're definitely not going to be filling the current 450 plus billion cubic meter, BCM, in cubic meter gas market with biogas and biomethane alone in the coming 30 years. It will play a part. It's part of the solution, John. It's not the only vector that we need. And I think Rob's probably going to say a bit more about other vectors.
Yeah. Okay, well, nice segue on to Rob. So with hydrogen, Rob, there's a lot of hope and, dare I say it, a bit of hype around hydrogen at the moment. It's not a source of energy, it's a, as James just said, it's an energy vector. So can you help us understand the different ways we could produce hydrogen and how to break hydrogen down a bit?
Yeah, of course. And an important thing to say is, in a similar manner to biogas or biomethane, it really depends on where your hydrogen comes from. You can broadly split down the production of hydrogen into two main methods of production. There is electrolysis, which essentially uses electricity as an input and splits water into constituents of hydrogen, which obviously we want, and an oxygen byproduct, which can still be sold on. The alternative to this is using an industrial process called steam methane reforming. This is quite a, well, it's a very CO2 intensive process that basically combines steam and methane to produce hydrogen and CO2. So talking about steam methane reforming, this is called grey hydrogen. So it's hydrogen, the vast majority of the hydrogen produced today is produced via grey processes.
Okay.
So very carbon intensive, and typically goes into industrial processes like fertilizer production, for instance.
Okay. So grey is then one variety of hydrogen. What else? What other colours do we have?
So going through the hydrogen rainbow, if you like, John, yeah. From grey, if we want to make that low carbon but still use a kind of centralised industrial process, we need to use what's called carbon capture and storage. So this is basically capturing the carbon emissions that would be emitted from grey hydrogen and storing them underground, typically okay. offshore. And this basically gives you one means of producing low carbon hydrogen, but importantly, not zero carbon hydrogen, because the capture processes are not 100% efficient.
Okay. And what color do we call that?
So that would be termed blue hydrogen. Okay. So gray hydrogen, very, very carbon intense industrial process. Blue hydrogen, low carbon intensity, but still industrial, still centralized.
Yeah. And now, then let's move back on to electrolysis then, because that's using electricity, which could come from different sources to produce hydrogen.
Exactly, exactly. So there are two colours of kind of electrolyzer-produced hydrogen. You've got brown, which uses grid electricity, so that can use whatever the constituent electricity in the grid. So in the UK, that might have gas-based electricity. In Germany, it might have coal-based electricity mixed with renewables.
Yeah.
So generally, would be considered a higher carbon hydrogen. Counteractive to that is green hydrogen, which is where you're fueling your electrolyzer with dedicated renewable electricity. And that's where you can really achieve this zero carbon hydrogen that will be so important in the future.
Okay, so today we're largely at grey hydrogen using steam reforming and natural gas. If we have CCS, we turn that into blue hydrogen. If we have electrolysis with the grid mix today, that's brown, and that could have varying degrees of carbon emissions. And if we use electrolysis, but from 100% renewable sources, then we have green, which is where we'd love to get to, I guess.
Exactly. You couldn't have explained it better, John. That's perfect.
Look, so in terms of where we're at with decarbonized gases, James, you sort of set the context at the beginning that we're at the beginning, not right at the very beginning, but very early on in the transition from natural gas to lower carbon gases. I'd like now to sort of understand a bit more about the types of projects, studies, drill down it into that journey towards lower carbon gases a bit. Rob, can you give us a feel for hydrogen and where are we at in terms of theoretical studies, technical trials, pilots, big demonstrations in using hydrogen, for example, to decarbonize heat?
Yeah, of course. And yeah, that's a really good starting point. And the truth is, there's a real variety of kind of projects that are currently active in decarbonizing heating, with specifically with hydrogen. These range from desk-based feasibility studies that are looking at, theoretically, if you were to convert a relatively large metropolitan area to using 100% hydrogen, how would you go about doing it? What are the actual practicalities involved in that?
Okay, so that's basically pushing hydrogen through the pipes that today carry natural gas and
exactly.
Having a city running on hydrogen.
Yes. So the famous kind of report that kicked a lot of this discussion off was the H21 project based in Leeds in the UK. And this basically had a look, taking lessons from the kind of town gas conversion in the UK, where we moved from basically a gasified coal to natural gas in the to produce heat. Mm-hmm. What lessons were learned from that, and what we can take that on to converting natural gas networks into hydrogen networks.
Okay, so on the basis we've converted a gas network before, can we do it again?
Exactly, yep. Exactly, yep. Spot on.
Yep.
So there are a few projects like that looking at feasibility studies. A really interesting one, again in the UK, is HyNet, which is looking at decarbonizing a current steam methane reformer and using that hydrogen to decarbonize an industrial hub and then spread out into domestic heat. So industry is very difficult to decarbonize, and hydrogen could be a really good solution for that, blue hydrogen specifically. Mm-hmm. And that kind of gives you a sort of industrial hub to then expand out into the domestic market.
Okay. James, how about your view of hydrogen in terms of any particular example projects or perspectives you'd like to draw out?
I think that Rob mentioned, of course, probably one of the most important in Europe that we see today, and that's the H21 project, looking up at Leeds, basically how you change a city of 1 million people from natural gas back to hydrogen. I would agree with the point that Rob made. It's kind of like going back to the future. And so I always tell people, if we came from a situation where we had town gas, we should be able to relatively easily go back to being able to change the grids and the infrastructure to deal with that. So H21 is a very important project, because in the next 10 years or so, it should be able to demonstrate the possibility of using hydrogen once again in the grid to deliver heat, deliver energy for industry. So we definitely see that as one of the important flagship projects, because in a way it's a very, very large demonstration project. And therefore, the whole kind of feasibility is important to show, and therefore it needs to deliver. I think the other point about town gas is that it's a European-wide phenomenon. I spoke to a number of the companies that make up our association, and you find that kind of history also in Germany. You have things like Stadtgas, which is the same basis. So indeed, a lot of the infrastructure in Europe would be ready to handle volumes of up to 50% hydrogen. So from this point of view, I think that we are very keen to see projects develop, and not just on the sort of blue hydrogen side. In Germany, we're also seeing a lot of companies considering how to invest more into power to gas, into electrolyzers. And you have to think of this as a European technology. It's something we have the lead in at the moment. I was fortunate enough to visit ITM Power, just outside Sheffield, who are moving to the largest electrolyzer manufacturing plant in the world in the coming year. And it's great to see this technology being developed in Europe, but also deployed in Europe. You know, in Germany, they have the big issue of trying to get all that wonderful wind energy in the north down to the south, and nobody wants to build high voltage frequency transmission lines on the electricity side past all these villages. It's not just Bavaria, you go Paderborn, Land, all the way to Niedersachsen. Nobody wants it. And in fact, many of the companies are now thinking if they can convert that into hydrogen using electrolyzers, they could actually ship it through existing gas infrastructure for the use by the industries in the south and would overcome the problems. There are examples of things like Store and Go. It's a project that's run by companies in Germany, and they're basically doing that. They're assessing the technology potential of converting electricity, renewable electricity, into hydrogen. And so I think there are a number of projects on the go. When I was at ITM, they were developing a very large electrolyzer for renewable electricity to produce hydrogen for use in buses in the town of Pau in France for their fleet. So I think that we are seeing a number of these projects being developed, and the numbers are growing. I think we're up to something like 600 megawatts of electrolyzer deployment in Germany. And so going back to my earlier point, we're at the beginning of the story, but as you said, quite rightly, John, it's not that nothing has been done. All of these technologies are in existence and are being deployed. And so I think we also have to recall that.
Okay.
So I think that's a really...
Sorry, go on, Rob.
I was going to say, I think that's... you've made some really important points there, James. And I think the kind of use of hydrogen is very... or the intended use of hydrogen could be very regional, even within Europe. So like you mentioned, James, power to gas and basically using electricity, constrained renewables that would produce electricity that is otherwise difficult to deal with, changing that into hydrogen and then putting that into a local gas grid. There's a project up in Schleswig-Holstein that's been doing this since the mid-2018. Essentially using constrained electricity and putting that into the gas grid. From what we've heard, Germany seems to be going down, seems to be a much stronger advocate of using electrolysis-based hydrogen production for constrained renewables. Whereas if you shift perhaps more towards the UK, and I'm trying to, being conscious not to be too UK-focused, there's a much stronger focus on dedicated hydrogen production for heating. So there are different ways of going about it, really, and I think that's important to emphasise. You know, we see a huge range of different projects. In fact, that moving on from that kind of power-to-gas argument, there's a really interesting project at the moment running in Sweden called RE8760.
That's a very catchy name, Rob.
I know it's not. I've had, yeah, it's not. You're right. But the project is incredibly interesting. Basically, it's a means. The project leaders have tried to get a total of 6 housing blocks, 172 flats, completely off grid electricity and grid heating. And how they've done this is by having a large solar park, so solar PV, using batteries to store that energy, so that you store the energy during the day and release it from the batteries during the night when demand is high. But they're also using inter-seasonal demand matching. So they use the electricity from those solar panels, store it as hydrogen, and then use a fuel cell micro CHP unit. So that's it's basically the reverse of an electrolyzer. It takes in hydrogen and produces electricity and a water byproduct. But you can also harness heat from that. So it uses that hydrogen that is stored up during the summer months and uses it to produce both heat and electricity in the winter months. So you have a really interesting kind of way of using hydrogen there.
And I think that brings up one of the areas that we'll see a lot more focus, research, analysis on from what you described in that system, Rob. you've got the benefits of that huge flexibility that hydrogen brings and that versatility, but you've also got inefficiencies from the conversions, the storage, and then the turning it back into heat and electricity. So I imagine we'll learn a lot more about these trade-offs or the values of flexibility comparison to generating electricity and storing it in a battery for short-term storage, for example. I think it's going to be a fascinating area.
Undoubtedly, John, undoubtedly.
Now, as always, time is getting the better of us, so I'd like to start looking forwards now. But before I bring out the talking new energy crystal ball, what's going to drive this market? So renewable, James, you mentioned at the beginning the transition that electricity has made over the last decade, sort of the transition it's making. And that's been driven by some very clear incentive programs, maybe some subsidy programs. You're able to use market-based mechanisms to make that shift. But are we going to see the same market-based mechanisms to decarbonize gas, do you think, James? Or will we see more regulatory intervention, do you think?
Well, I suspect you're going to need a bit of both, actually, John. I think this is really the way that we would see things in Eurogas. If you look at what's been done on the electricity side to grow solar from nothing to sort of 4 or 5% of the electricity mix, there's been a fair deal of intervention, if you like. And the real point of that is that the European level, a renewable energy directive was set up that targeted 20% of energy to be from renewable sources by 2020. And the governments of Europe clubbed together and or acted on their own and came up with their own ideas of how they would best achieve those objectives. And generally, many of the countries use feed-in tariffs, not always with the best outcome. And I don't mean that deployment was somehow slowed. It's just that often those programs of incentives had to be closed early because they were massively oversubscribed. So the way that we look at things is that we probably need that mix. So we're totally in favor of setting targets for renewable gas penetration into the natural gas segment. But we also believe that we should look at the development of things like guarantees of origin, i.e. certificates that prove that you get for every, say, megawatts or megawatt hour you produce of a renewable gas, you receive a certificate for it, which you could also use to encourage people to buy that gas, and which in itself could also turn into a market and be traded, and therefore encourage investments in its own right. I think we have to look at both measures. I would say that probably, you know, we wouldn't preclude any form, though in principle, we'd probably prefer the idea of auctions or tenders, if you prefer, because these tenders provide a certain degree of public incentive, but also put pressure on the companies that take part to reduce costs, which is what we need. And so you bring the sort of market element into it. There's competitiveness and incentive, a carrot and stick kind of approach through a tender. And I think that's probably the right way to go. I think if we leave it to the market to do everything on its own without putting these kind of incentives in place, it would take quite a long time to drive those things forward, because you're talking about biomethane today being the four times the cost of natural gas. So you need to do it to drive the change, because the market on its own will always favour the cheapest. And in electricity or gas, it's always the fossil fuel that's the cheapest. That's just how it is.
Yeah. Okay, so we need to intervene with, we need the right kind of mechanisms, and market mechanisms could work in this case. Rob.
I might just add, John, just one thing before we go through. Yep. There is a practical example of how this is working. And France set a target of 10% of all of its gas to be renewable by 2030. And what we've actually seen is that since that came in, you're seeing a doubling of the amount of biomethane plants every year. So I think this came in 2015. And in 2016, the number of plants from 17 to 26. In 2017, there were 44. And in 2018, 76. So you're almost doubling year on year because the target was put in place. So I just want to say this isn't some sort of up in the air fantasy notion. We've looked at it. We've seen how it's worked in France. And it seems to be a good way of actually driving the change that we need.
Okay. Rob, I was going to ask you, in terms of switching part of the network over to from natural gas to hydrogen, that's that probably will be a policy decision. That can't be left, or it's much harder to leave that to the market. Which countries, you mentioned UK, is there anywhere else, Rob, you'd look in terms of switching a network wholly over to hydrogen for early activity?
Definitely. I think other than the UK, which has had quite a lot of government backing or government interest, the Netherlands is also very, very hot in this area. They're looking at a range of solutions. And to be honest, in the Netherlands, there are probably more projects where you've already got small networks of 100% hydrogen already heating homes. They tend to be very isolated, typically serving a couple of apartment blocks, but that's already going ahead, which is probably a little bit of an advance of what the UK is doing. So if I was going to highlight two major markets, I would say the UK and the Netherlands are probably leading. Mm-hmm. But as James said earlier, you know, Germany shouldn't be neglected, but they're coming at it from a slightly different viewpoint, I think.
Okay. Well, let's now bring out the talking new energy crystal ball and wrap up by looking forward to 2030. And I'd like to ask each of you briefly to say one or two key things you think we'll have seen happen in this area by 2030. James, do you want to go first?
I think that what we'll definitely see by 2030 is an increasing volume of renewable gases. I think this is almost an inevitability. In Eurogas, we're hoping that there will be EU targets for renewable gases put in place. We would also like to see a target for what we call decarbonized gas, which is essentially referring to hydrogen, hydrogen being produced primarily from CCS, carbon capture and storage. But in the field, I guess that what we would also like to see is that the projects that we've mentioned today, that these are moving beyond sort of demonstration, and that we are able to see more and more commercialized projects being deployed. And that really does depend on getting the frameworks right. But we believe that you will not be able to reach the objectives of 2050, let alone by 2030, if you don't put the right regulatory framework in place. And so we really believe that having things like guarantees of origin for renewable gas and targets will be the cornerstones of this change.
And thanks, James. And Rob, how about you by 2030? Is there one or two things you'd highlight?
I'm going to be quite ambitious here, but I think what I'd love to have seen by 2030 is at least one large scale project to produce kind of industrial volumes of hydrogen, whether that be a dedicated offshore wind farm for producing hydrogen, for instance, produce green hydrogen, or a large scale blue hydrogen industrial site. I think once we see hydrogen being generated at scale, it's just a matter of time before it starts to sort of trickle down into domestic heating, into transport, which is something we haven't been able to touch on in this session, but is a really interesting sector. So that's what I would like to see, hydrogen being produced at scale. In the domestic sector, in terms of heating, I think it's not too ambitious to say, I think we'll see small gas networks serving, you know, the high hundreds, low thousands of homes with 100% hydrogen. I think that will definitely be a possibility, perhaps in the UK or Netherlands. So those are my two hot takes, I guess.
Okay, well, we'll bring you both back in 2030 and see if your predictions or your outlook is correct. As you've both mentioned, there's lots of other issues, topics in this area of hydrogen and low carbon gases, and we'll come back to them in future podcasts. James and Rob, thank you both very much for helping us navigate and understand this really important part of the energy system. So thanks to each of you.
Thank you, John.
Yeah, no worries. It's a pleasure.
And as always, thank you to our listeners. We hope you have enjoyed the episode and found it useful, and look forward to welcoming you back next week. Thank you very much, and goodbye.